Yes, I'm giving a talk on screens from my screen with a screen in front of me and multiple screens around me. Get over it. There's going to be a lot more nuance to this conversation by the time we're done with today in the series, so brace yourselves. I'm already comfortable with the irony of this conversation. This series, for me, is something that I both was kind of dreading and putting off because I knew how heavy it was, but also I know that I'm especially equipped to be able to have this conversation because of the generation that I am, how I was raised. But I really have been wanting to make sure I get this right. There's a lot of nuance to this conversation. It's complex, it's heavy. I had my laptop in bed with me past midnight last night, which I never do, because I just kept having ideas and come into my head, and I was typing, and Lisa wasn't there, so I didn't keep her up. She's out of town right now, which should be evident by the way I'm dressed. She doesn't dress me, but we do at least check off of each other, and I have the ability to say, it's too much, and she's like, yeah, too much, and she wasn't here this morning, so this is what I got. It's like I got hiking pants and like a rock band shirt and kind of the hippie vibe up top, and I'm still not sure what I'm doing with my hair. There's going to be a few more things that you're going to kind of learn from me or about me during this series that I'm going to reveal. You've not seen the depth, the complexity of my essence. Sounds terrible. Oh, my gosh. But the two things are, one, I have a real strong, I love teaching and distilling content. You may have noticed when we did the last series, the Psychedelic Summer, we kind of worked with a definition set, and I've got another set of definitions here that we're going to be kind of building off of to help expand our knowledge and our understanding of these topics. The other piece that is going to come out loud and clear and strong is the geeky, nerdy side of me, which may not be so surprising to you, but trust me, you've not seen even the tip of the iceberg. Not even close. And when it comes to talks and series, I try to answer two questions. So what and now what? When I'm exploring a topic, you know, so what? How does this matter to me and to my audience, the people listening? And I guarantee you this topic could not be more relevant. You cannot ignore it no matter how much you want to. Even if you unplug, if you took charity's advice, which, what a fantastic setup for this talk. I love that. But if you did, if you took her advice and just carried a stone around in your pocket instead of a phone, you still, just by the act of being and existing in this world, are feeding AI systems that are monitoring you through cameras and street traffic, your movement, as cameras are trained to recognize with optical character recognition on license plates. You're in this already. The reason we call it an empire is because you were born into it. You didn't ask to be born into it, but you were, and you can't simply opt out unless you like go live maybe in the mountains somewhere where there's like no cameras watching you or no Wi-Fi. And trust me, I've thought about that. Especially in this last couple weeks. I've been reading a lot about this topic, and it's heavy content, but I want to try to take an approach that's not so heavy to it, if that makes sense, right? So this is really heavy stuff. We'll pause every so often if we need to take a breath, to reconnect ourselves. If you have a rock, I was, you know, kicking myself that I didn't bring my pocket rock this morning because, man, in the morning, when I'm surrounded by so much screens and technology, talking about screens and technology, I need connections to nature and the reminder of where my true essence lies. So we're gonna cover some heavy topics. We're not gonna do it in a heavy way. Let me first start by introducing myself to you. This was me in 1985. I was born in Detroit, Michigan in 1977. The same year, incidentally, that Star Wars came out. What a fantastic year. Do we have anybody born in 1977, that year? Nobody. Love it. I'm the only one in the whole room. No, that's all right. I know you were. No. Okay. I'm what's referred to as a Xennial. So it's this cusp generation in between Gen X and Millennials. And they call this generation by a specific kind of a blended name because we're a micro-generation. I know this sounds pretentious already, but anybody born between 1977 all the way up to 1985. Do we have anybody joining me now? Okay, now we've got some hands. All right, so everybody look around. Keep the hands up. These are the Xennials in the room. Born between 1977 to 1985. Okay, very good. Thank you. We grew up in a unique intersection of an analog childhood and a digital adulthood, which gives us a very unique perspective. I would dare say that almost every single person that raised their hand would be more technologically savvy than your average person and would have experiences and stories of joining new technologies and the impact it had on their life. We're also called the Oregon Trail generation. You can probably guess why, that for many of us in our formative years, we're spent playing Oregon Trail, oftentimes in computer labs of schools. Actually, though, Oregon Trail was not my go-to game. Mine was a game called Aztec. And it played, I'm gonna really, you know, show you my depth of experience with technology. It played on a 5 1/4 inch floppy disk. Has anyone ever used a 5 1/4 inch floppy disk? There we go. Now we got some hands coming up there. Okay. This game was incredible. I played it so much as a kid, and I wish I could like play the YouTube video because I found a gameplay video this last night when I was up too late, and I thought, oh, this would be so fun to play, but it's too long. I mean, like, seriously, it takes 2 minutes just for the game to load. And I love that this emulator that's playing this game on this YouTube video has the sound of the disk drive doing as it's reading the disk. Such a memorable sound. As soon as I heard that, it made me smile because I remember my game loading. And if it didn't load properly, you would hit the side of your computer. No joke. The connections were so rustic of sorts that, like, sometimes all you need to do is just give it a slap, and then it would come back into alignment. I loved Aztec. Played on a 5 1/4 floppy on my Apple II Plus. You may think you're an early Apple adopter. I had my first Apple computer as a child, as an Apple II Plus, and I learned basic level programming as my dad got these programming books and brought them home for me, and we made it say hello and do some random things. As I grew up in the 90s, we connected to the internet with something that was like this. Does anybody recognize this? Sounds like this. Anybody recognize this sound? This is another nostalgic sound for me. That was how we used to connect to the internet. And you'd get kicked off if somebody was picked up the phone and you're yelling and fights. Connected first with a 28.8K. That was 28.8 kilobauds. And we felt it was a huge upgrade when we upgraded to 56.6, and that was a big upgrade. I was working at an internet service provider at the time. I was the webmaster for this company. We had about 40,000 subscribers in and around Michigan. It was called the Internet Ramp, TIR.com. Does anybody remember that? Maybe subscribers back in the day? Okay, it was worth a shot. We were an internet service provider, ISP. That was how people connected to the internet then, much like you would connect maybe through Metronet or whatever else. But you were a subscriber and you would get a phone number and you would plug in your phone jack to the back of your modem and it would dial this number and it would play that sound and it would connect you to this incredible place where you could chat with people with AOL Instant Messenger, AIM. at another time, I'll have to show you Lisa and I in our early romantic connections. We chatted with each other on AIM. I think her handle was something like Tweety Bird, and we kind of leaned into it. It was so weird. I mean, the chats are cringy now, but we saved them all. We printed them all these years later. It was pretty cool. I mean, that was a big part of our romantic relationship growing up there. And when you installed software, you installed it with CD-ROMs now. You were getting more advanced, but you could still not play or access the content unless that CD was in there. And if that CD got scratched, you're screwed, buddy. Connected through graphic design as computers upgraded. We had this beautiful iMac. Did anybody use one of those back in the day? Isn't that a beautiful device there, kind of like a jelly bean and had all those colors? My interest in graphic design and computers goes way back. I started first with Adobe Photoshop 3.0, which doesn't mean a lot to a lot of people, but I know it means something to a couple people who are nodding some heads as they know how far back that goes. This was in around 1997. I went to a vocational technical school and just voraciously devoured all these tutorials as I'm learning about how I can create digital composite images. One of the very first Photoshop images that I still have, this, keep in mind, this is a ways back, but it was this image right here. I took three photographs of myself, and at this time, there was no digital camera, so they were real film photographs that we took to the lab, got developed, and came back, and then you scanned them, right? And it was myself and my brother, and then I kind of cloned myself to make it look like there were three of me, and I didn't have the technology to change the way my hair went for that one over there, so he's kind of the weird one, I guess. But I had my whole class convinced that I was triplets. This was early enough on where photoshopping things was still new and novel. And I thought it was pretty fascinating that I could insert myself into the computer, much like Tron, the movie I grew up loving, right? You know, you digitally enter this new domain. This next one here, the Mask of Zorro, this movie came out with Antonio Banderas in around 1998. I made this. I wasn't super creative. It says Bradtonio L. Ruggles. That's me. I was fantasizing that I was Antonio Banderas. When I got my first phone, you want to guess what kind of phone it was? It wasn't an iPhone. This was before those even came out there. It was a flip phone. It was the Motorola i1000, which was a specific, unique phone because it combined a digital phone, which was new at that time, and a two-way talk communication. You may have heard that, dee-dee. And then you would talk, and then oftentimes using construction jobs, lots of art. It was quite a fascinating technology. It's very much akin to getting a text message now in that it just comes, boom, out of nowhere. And sometimes you're in a, you know, quiet place and you'd get that. But that was my first phone. And then when I began to get into music and digital music, I had lots of early MP3 players and servers where I played my music, but the first time I got into the iPhone or iPod game was in 2006 with the iPod Classic. That was the first one that had the color screen, and you would navigate it using that thumb wheel, and you could scroll through thousands of songs in the palm of your hand. How wild was that? I can't emphasize enough how crazy it was to, in my lifetime, go from music transitioning from vinyl and 8-tracks to cassettes to CDs to digital to MP3s, and now I'm carrying around thousands of songs and albums right in my hand. It was mind-blowing. One of our first businesses, Lisa and I, as we were both entrepreneurial, was selling things on this new site that came out called eBay. And we would buy pallets of returned goods, and we would relist them and create listings and sell it online. Those businesses are still around today, although they're becoming less frequent. But in the early days, when our kids were young, Chloe, I think, was one or two, and Emily had just been born. This was in around 2002, we would get these pallets, and we sold everything from a pallet of returned fishing rods from Walmart to these embroidered vests that grandmas wore, kind of a thing, but sold really, really hot on eBay. Like, we began to research trends of, like, what is selling on eBay? And you're like, oh my gosh, look at this sweater. It's so ugly, and it sold for, like, $85, right? So, like, I was introduced to a whole new way of engaging with people across the United States with a platform. Like, my first social media was the OG social media, MySpace. Does anybody remember having, or did you have a MySpace account? A couple of you? Keep your hands up. Let me see. All right. We got a handful of you. MySpace was at one point, this is hard to fathom, was at one point the most popular social media site. It far surpassed Facebook in the early days. Facebook only surpassed MySpace in 2008. There were multiple years where MySpace reigned supreme, and its horrible layout and crazy design themes were used by everybody, but it allowed you to connect with people. Now, since then you had the rise of Internet 2.0. And before long, I started to go back and think about all the different apps that I used or was early adopters on. Vimeo, YouTube, early on. In the early days, YouTube was definitely not what it is now. You could actually watch engaging content, and it was fascinating that there were people creating instructional videos, educational content, universities posting lectures. It was fascinating. Gmail, I still was early enough on to get my own name at Gmail without having to add crazy numbers and stuff like you have to do now. MySpace, Flickr, LinkedIn, Blogger. I was a big blogger. I used first the Blogger platform in 2003. I later went on to launch a blog that I ran from about 2006 to maybe 2012. That blog connected me with people across the United States and around the world that I'm still in touch with today. Through that blog, I was able to generate sponsorships through a child sponsorship organization called Compassion International, who sent me and other and about five or six other prominent bloggers on a blogging tour to Kenya, Nairobi, Kenya, and we blogged about our experiences, shared the stories, and generated new child sponsorships and new funding for people in impoverished areas. While I was there, I connected with another individual who did work in the slums of Kibera, and his name is Fred, and I'm still in touch with him today. I'm grateful for the platform that I had and what it opened up for me. You know, back then, everything felt new and exciting. Each new app was something that you wanted to download. Some of the best apps had waiting lists, and you were so anxious to get on that list. The internet was a playground, a digital frontier, a way to connect, to express ourselves. But then somewhere along the way, it became overwhelming, didn't it? The novelty faded. What began as a few fun websites and social media platforms has become a digital ecosystem that surrounds nearly every moment of our life. John Culkin said, "We shape our tools, and thereafter our tools shape us." Tools are not just simply passive instruments. They change our behaviors, and they reshape societies. All those apps that I talked about earlier, and you saw those logos, have affected society and each of us in ways we can't even fathom. It's so ubiquitous that we don't notice it because it is the air that we breathe. It is the very waters that we are swimming in. Here's some rather discouraging facts about our connection to screens. The average American spends 7 hours and 3 minutes looking at screens every day. That's screens of all sorts, from phones to watches to connected devices on our iPads and our screens there that go and connect to our cars. There's countless screens that we don't even pay attention to. And Gen Z is even worse. Gen Z accounts for about 9 hours of screen time every single day. 49%, nearly half of infants age birth to 2 years old, regularly interact with smartphones. I know this because I have my YouTube account that is left signed on in our various Airbnbs that we own. And unfortunately, it is linked to my personal account, and I need to keep switching it back over because I go into my history feed and I keep seeing all of these Roblox videos and things that I know young kids are watching hours at a time. And I'm not saying this in a judgmental way, trust me, because I was a parent and I was raising kids. Lisa and I raised kids in the very beginning of answering these kind of questions. What kind of social media should we even let them have? What kind of access? When do they get a phone? How do they get connected? What's the safe way to do it? We didn't do it right. I don't know that anybody did. We tried. It was really, really tough to raise kids in a digital age, and it's getting tougher all the time, especially when so many are waking up in their existence in this world, and the very first thing that they're seeing in the first 2 years of their life is being connected to digital devices that are watching them as they watch it. Average U.S. household has 21 connected devices as of 2023. Chris Hayes, in his book, The Siren's Call, How Attention Became the World's Most Endangered Resource, said this. He said, information is abundant. I want to stop and pause on that first because we can't fathom how quickly information became accessible everywhere. In the early days of the internet, it was fascinating and intriguing and exciting that you could condense whole troves of knowledge into these digital libraries that anybody could access. And in the open web days, that was the hope that by getting information out to the masses, with enough information, we'll be free and everybody can pull themselves up out of ignorance and poverty. But what we found is that information became abundant, and then attention became the new commodity that was scarce. Information is theoretically infinite, while attention is constrained. As Sammy pointed out, yes, we pay attention. I'm grateful that you took time out of your week to sit in these chairs to engage with this topic, and you're paying with your eyeballs your attention. And every time we pick up our phones, watch a streaming show, get into our car, pull up directions, check out at a restaurant, we're engaging with these systems and giving them our attention. This is why information is cheap and attention is expensive. So how did I land on the title for this series? I borrowed this idea from an author, Karen Howe, who wrote a book called The Empire of AI. It just came out. It was a heavy read. I've read two such books that really take a behind-the-scenes look at the people running these mega empires in Silicon Valley. The other one was Careless People. Forget the author, but it talks about Mark Zuckerberg and the Meta Corporation and all the things. But The Empire of AI is a concept that I want to really flesh out in the series because we're surrounded by devices that connect us to a world around us that's larger and all of it accessible at the swipe of a finger, at the blink of an eye. And the idea of calling it an empire came from this notion that it is pervasive. You didn't join it. You were born into it. It exists outside of the realms of your control, and it's shaping you, your kids, your grandkids, your nieces, your nephews, old and young. No one is exempt from the influence. Karen Howe said, over the years, I found only one metaphor that encapsulates the nature of what these AI power players are, empires. She goes on to say, during the long era of European colonialism, empires seized and extracted resources that were not their own. They exploited the labor of a people they subjugated to mine, cultivate, and refine those resources for the empire's enrichment. They projected racist, dehumanizing ideas of their own superiority and modernity to justify the invasion of sovereignty, the theft, and the subjugation. Does this sound familiar? They justified their quest for power by the need to compete with other empires. In an arms race, all bets are off. And this ultimately served to entrench each empire's power and to drive its expansion and progress. In the simplest terms, she says, empires amassed extraordinary resources and riches across space and time through imposing a colonial world order at a great expense to everyone else. We call this an empire because we're seeing this happen now. It's already happening. There's the extraction of resources. Like historical empires of old, today's digital empire seizes what it needs: our data, our content, our creativity, our biometric information, the labor of low-wage workers to train and moderate these systems, to build data farms in impoverished areas and extract local resources, even land, water, and energy for massive data centers. Much of this happens without our consent or fair compensation. Your data that is powering or that is used to train the models, the AI models that are existing out there, was extracted from you without your consent or cooperation or notice. I guarantee you that you have content that is in the data training sets for these new AI systems. Were never asked, you were never consulted. Empires have stories of justification, this manifest destiny. We were made to do this. You're hearing this now from Sam Altman, from others who are talking about themselves almost in godlike terms, like this technology is coming. We're the best ones to usher this into the world. And so there's these stories of justification, and they're so good at painting a picture of this glorious world. Robert Oppenheimer said technology happens because it is possible. An adage that is often used and repeated in Silicon Valley. Sam Altman, the co-founder and CEO of OpenAI, who has given us ChatGPT and other tools, is known to be a big fan of Oppenheimer because he sees himself, much like Oppenheimer, ushering in a technology that has potential to rule or to end the world, and yet somebody has to do it. Technology happens because it's possible. And so there's these stories of justification. Altman took many of his developers and executives to the first screenings of Oppenheimer when the film came out to remind all of them what they were creating, the potential for harm. And much like in the initial tests, when the general was asking, what is the percentage of likelihood that this will blow up the world? And he says, it's not zero. We are going into the world of AI with much the same likelihoods. If anything, they're far worse odds. And then there's the concentration of power through profits that flow upward to a small elite. I'm going to just briefly reference a couple of these terms, these definitions that we're going to flesh out in the weeks ahead, and encourage you, if you want to participate in this conversation and to educate yourself, the best way outside of this would be to get on the email list when I send out those email recaps every week, because I'm able to fit a lot more links and resources and videos for anybody who wants to go deeper. And I encourage all of us to become familiar with the digital waters that we swim in. So this first term, I've kind of fleshed out this idea of a digital empire. We call it empire because it's extractive, it's exploitive. You were born into it, and it has a concentration of power and resources that keeps getting greater and greater by held by fewer and fewer people. And then algorithms are these instructions that inform much of our life today. We're going to be talking more about that in the weeks ahead. So here's my invitation for us, because this is some heavy content. We're going to start just at a surface level of paying attention to where our attention is going this week. So I want all of us to notice your screen usage. And to do so, this is so key, okay, because I don't want to be part of another talk or another podcast or something that just you listen to and you just feel like going out and hanging yourself and like, what is even, what's the hope? How are we ever going to get out of this, right? It can be very overwhelming. I get that, all right? I mean, like, during the last couple of weeks, I've gotten more and more conspiracy-minded at how deep these pervasive injustices run. I've thought about, do I need a bunker? I mean, is it time yet? Is the world really ending? It's heavy. There's a lot. So we're coming at this with curiosity instead of judgment, okay? When you're looking at your screen usage and your connection to that, don't do so beating yourself up this week, but just notice, because awareness is the first step towards living wisely in this digital empire. Empires thrive when people stop noticing who's in charge. And the digital empire begins to lose its power when we become educated. So my encouragement is to start by counting your screens in your home, connected devices. You may be surprised how many things are connected to the internet or to other devices, to track your use, and you don't even have to do that. Modern smartphones will track it for you. If you're on an Apple, you can go to settings. There's a device called Screen Time that you can turn on and you can view app usage. How many times you pick up your phone, it tracks that. Did you know that? Because they're not doing this to help you, it helps them, and they're just sharing it with you. That behavioral data is the tip of the iceberg of information that they collect. And then Androids have something called digital well-being that tracks app usage, unlocks, notifications. So just track your use this week. Watch it, pay attention, and reflect. Notice with curiosity instead of judgment. It's a heavy topic. There's a lot that we're going to be going into, but we don't have to be overwhelmed. We can learn and educate ourselves. And it's our responsibility to educate ourselves as we move forward into this digital empire that we're in. Thank you for being such good sports on all of this. I know this is probably really heavy for us as a community to absorb, but I think it's necessary. So I hope we can lean into this conversation and educate ourselves as we go.